To emerge a butterfly, a caterpillar dissolves inside its chrysalis and builds a brand new brain, wings, and legs. But butterflies aren't alone. From poisonous frogs and jungle canopies to immortal jellyfish and frigid ocean depths, a stunning 3/4 of all animal species undergo dramatic metamorphosis. Why must creatures go through this massive destruction and remodeling to become who they are? In the new book Metamorphosis, science historian Orrin Harmon traces a path from Aristotle to Darwin to cutting-edge science today to explore this central mystery. Again, the name of the book, Metamorphosis, A Natural and Human History. The book is published by Basic Books, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Orrin Harmon to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate you being here.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So what brought this topic? I know you teach in science technology, and I'm curious as to what brought you to this particular subject of wanting to write about it in such detail.
My wife emerged from the shower one evening with a white plastic stick and two little pink lines on it and announced that we were pregnant. She was pregnant. We were pregnant for the third time. And we were joyous and extremely excited. And then night after night, I started having these dreams of a childhood dry aquarium that I used to have when I was a kid and a butterfly collector. And I used to wake up in the middle of the night to try to catch a butterfly, a blue butterfly coming out of the chrysalis. And those were precious childhood moments. But I was now, as an adult, over 50, dreaming them night after night after night. So I started thinking that someone's trying to tell me something, that there might be a connection between the impending birth of our third child and this wondrous natural phenomenon of metamorphosis.
You say natural, obviously, but it is still a great mystery, isn't it, of what is going on there as that metamorphosis is happening?
It is still a mystery. I mean, it has been a mystery for over 2,000 years. And the ancient Greeks tried to figure things out, early Christians into the 19th century, after Darwin, it suddenly, the question had a new twist to it. And until this very day in cutting edge labs, we are still trying to figure out the mystery. We have been quite successful, especially over the last 50 years, figuring out what are the genes involved, what are the hormones involved and the pathways that allow for such dramatic transformation. But the question why it exists, why do creatures have to destroy themselves and rebuild themselves to become who they are, that question remains to some great degree still unanswered.
So before we get into that, let me just ask you, going back to of the mystery aspect of this. So give us a sense of what the ancient Greeks and the early modern Christians thought of this and how we've progressed since then of those early thinking.
So Aristotle had this kind of hierarchy of perfection and imperfection describing the creatures in the world. And it culminated in the most perfect creature of all, which was the human. But creatures that were less perfect were the kinds of creatures that had to go through a second transformation in order to become themselves. The reason they had to do that, in his mind, was because they never had sex. And it was the male who provided sort of the essence of the creature. The female only brought the matter. And because he didn't observe insects, for example, having sex, then they didn't have an essence because they didn't have a father. So they had to go through a second transformation. The curious thing about that is that he actually did observe. He did observe insects having sex. So what's going on here? Well, if you remember that Aristotle also insisted that females, human females, have less teeth in their mouths than males do, then you begin to understand that this is yet another instance of how social mores, social and cultural mores, in this case, what it is to be a female and what it is to be a male, can be so strong that they can impact not only what a scientist or a philosopher can think, but also what they can see. So those are the ancients. Going forward to the early modern Christians, well, when they looked at metamorphosis, what they saw was the transfiguration of Jesus to Christ. And so this was a kind of earthly reminder that deliverance was possible. And that's how they understood metamorphosis. They looked at the phenomenon through that gaze, through that window. In the 19th century, we learned through Darwin that actually creatures are constantly changing. They're changing in their lineage, not just in their development. And then we were able to ask and to better also comprehend that there is a connection, say, between some tiny flapping angelic creature, minuscule in the midwaters, that doesn't look anything like a starfish, and its starfish adult, which resides on the seafloor. Some of that wasn't even known before. Like we hadn't understood the connection between these two creatures. And now we suddenly could. And into the 20th century, we started probing the question from a molecular standpoint and unraveling that mystery at the molecular level.
I was fascinated, and it's a very interesting chapter about halfway through the book, but you write about eels. Give us a sense of why the eel is so significant and why it has baffled people for so long, including Sigmund Freud.
Yes, that's a great story. So the eels were in Europe, especially the Italians, love eating eels. And there are accounts going back to banquets with Julius Caesar and many eels on the table and everyone eating with great relish and so forth. But no one knew where eels came from because no one saw an eel having sex. And so there were all kinds of ideas about where they came from. There was some bishop who believed that eels rubbed up against rocks and that's how they created themselves kind of spontaneously, fissuring like that. There was a natural philosopher who published in the pages of the Royal Society of London saying that eels hatched on thatched roofs, fertilized by the sun. And no one really knew. And then a scientist, a German by the name of Schmidt, noticed that there are these tiny, tiny, tiny specks of life. They're just 5 millimeters in length that were called Leptocephalus brevisoris, so short-headed creatures with a short nose. And he saw that they have exactly 115 vertebrae. And so he went looking in the ocean for another creature that had 115 vertebrae. And he found an eel. And so it became clear that these two creatures are connected, that this creature must go through some sort of metamorphosis because the little speck of life looks nothing like an eel. And then began this sort of drive to discover the origins of the eel, which led a Dane into the Sea of Saragossa near Bermuda, where he finally located the origins. Where Sigmund Freud comes in this story is quite amazing because although they found the origins, no one found any ovaries in an eel. And again, no one had seen an eel have sex. So the young Sigmund Freud spent a summer towards the end of the 19th century cutting up eels and looking for their ovaries completely unsuccessfully. He wrote to a friend that unfortunately eels don't leave notebooks. They don't leave their thoughts in a diary. And so he moved on, as it were, to less slippery to less slippery subjects, the human psyche. But just to give you the immense scope of the metamorphosis of the eel, it is born in the Saragossa Sea near Bermuda. And then it migrates about 5,000 kilometers to the mouths of European rivers, and turns in its first metamorphosis into something called an elver, which is like looks like a tiny worm. And the tiny worm starts kind of walking up into the rivers against the current until it finds a den and it sits there. And it grows into this very serpentine hunter, which is very territorial and can live there for about 50 or even 60 years. At a certain point, it turns downward back to the ocean. And before it joins the Atlantic again, it loses its mouth. Its eyes become crystalline for swimming underwater, sometimes a mile down. And it makes its way back to its origins, where it was born, 5,000 kilometers away in the Sargasso Sea, in order to start the life cycle anew.
Oren Harmon is our guest. The name of the new book is Metamorphosis, A Natural and Human History. You described this, but when your wife comes out with the pregnancy test and you see those lines and then you start to have these dreams, as you start this, I mean, what was going on there? Can we look at that as a form of metamorphosis?
Yeah, so the big question is, are we humans? Are we metamorphic?
Right.
And we don't consider ourselves to be, but you tell me. Let me tell you a story about a kid by the name of Evan Miller, who murdered his neighbor in a trailer park in Alabama and was convicted of murder and given life without parole by an Alabama court. His lawyers took the case to the Supreme Court. And in Miller v. Alabama from 2012, the justices heard amicus curiae provided by his lawyers to the effect that the brains of an adolescence are just not fully baked. The pruning hasn't happened. The axons haven't been myelinated. You cannot treat an adolescent the same way you treat an adult because it's a different creature biologically. And the highest court in the land decided, indeed, and until this day, the decision stands that you cannot give life without parole to a juvenile killer. And so we appeal to biology in order to explain ourselves to ourselves and to make moral judgments about how we should treat one another. And so the definition of metamorphosis is really quite fuzzy when you look at it. It's dramatic post-embryonic development. So off the bat, you can see there's something quite arbitrary about this. I mean, how dramatic does dramatic change have to be to count as metamorphic? And then who gets to decide? So looking at the story of metamorphosis all the way back to the Greeks and until this day, the answer is that change is really in the eye of the beholder. We negotiate what change means. And therefore, metamorphosis is a wonderful prism to look at ourselves carefully and to understand our own relationships to selfhood and identity.
Meanwhile, we're not all that great with change, are we?
We have a very ambivalent relationship to change. I mean, you look at the mirror and you weep, you say, wait a second, am I the same person that I was 20 years ago? But at the same time, we praise the wisdom that comes with wrinkles. So we're quite ambivalent about change. Change is inevitable. And for many, it sort of marks endings. And yet, when you look at it biologically and also culturally, change is also about beginnings and also about continuations. It harbors great hope with it. You know, a lowly worm can turn into a stunningly beautiful butterfly. And these metaphors mean something to us humans when we think about our own evanescence and our own changeability.
What do you hope people will take from this book in understanding metamorphosis and understanding a bit more about us?
I think that when we think about metamorphosis, we often think of a very dramatic moment when a creature that appears in one guise, transforms overnight into something completely different. But one lesson from the book is that dramatic change is always preceded by a slow and highly choreographed and often invisible preparation. So think of, the cicadas that emerge every 13 or 17 years. They've been going through molts, five molts in the soil, unbeknownst to us all that time. And the same with the mayfly, which appears every May in European rivers, and lives fleetingly for just 24 hours, because on its last molt, it loses its mouth and it needs to, mate very quickly on its energy reserves. So one thing is that metamorphosis has a backside to it, and that backside is slow and it's highly, highly choreographed, and it's necessary. The other thing is that we also think of it kind of linearly. You're an egg, and then you're a larva, and then you're a pupa, and then you're an adult. But in fact, there's a cyclicality to metamorphosis. There's kind of a return, a perennial return, and nothing teaches us that lesson better than the immortal jellyfish, which, like Benjamin Button, can become a grown-up, but then, quote unquote, decide to return to its childhood, to its egg state and a planula, and go through its life cycle once again. So I think that in human terms, the most salient lesson that I learned over the last 6, 7 years of working on metamorphosis is that transformations are always a kind of return to self. They're a way for us to return to who we are. In a different guise, whether we change physically or whether the change is really more internal. And it's an opportunity to examine who we are through a process of change, which is both scary and edifying and also very beautiful.
The name of the book, Metamorphosis, A Natural and Human History. It is published by Basic Books. Orrin Harmon is the author. Orrin, thank you very much for spending time with us. A delightful conversation, and I thank you very much for sharing with us.
Thank you so much, Joe. Thank you all.
Be well. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Metamorphosis, A Natural and Human History. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.